Welcome to Roll Over Gutenberg and Tell McLuhan the News. My name is George Kelly. I'm an online coordinator for Bay Area News Group East Bay. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm your panelist. And that means you all are my audience. And as such, I have some things to talk about with you, but ideally, you all have some things to talk about with me. This is not to give away my responsibility to give you something with which you can walk out of here, but it's your license to stand up and walk to the microphone and pop up when something occurs to you. I described the panel as a way for print publications to forge deeper, more satisfying relationships with their readers and communities through presence and attention-centered microblogging clients like Twitter or Pounce or Jaiku, and I also threw out some other names, YouTube, Vimeo, SoundSlides. Clearly, the environment has changed in a lot of ways, and not simply because we're able to have sites with all of these widgets and toys and wonderful flashy things, but the environment has changed for the corporations and the businesses and the going concerns that give us the brand names we're used to thinking of going to, you know. The New York Times is laying off a bunch of people. They're going to have to continue their work and figure out how to do the job that enables them to keep nytimes.com up when news breaks about Elliot Spitzer and people want to know what the heck just happened. And they crash the site, as happened yesterday. I've been coming to South by Southwest since 2003. I started as a panelist with my friends and colleagues, Jason Tony, Tiffany B. Brown. A couple of them are back here. Stand up and say hi. Just wave. It's Tuesday afternoon. It's 3:30. I understand. We were on a Blogging While Black panel and talking about what it's like to be part of the blogosphere and deal with issues of identity and community. Last year, I had the good fortune to be on a panel about attention, identity, presence, and reputation with experts in the field like Ted Nadeau and Kalia Hamlin and Christian Crumlish. I'm forgetting one other panelist's name. I'm hoping they're not in the room right now. I'm an online coordinator, and that means my job is to teach writers and columnists at the paper where I work, the Contra Costa Times in Walnut Creek, California, how to blog, how to simply think of, you know, more than just a blog post as a paragraph or a series of column inches, but making sure they add links. You're trying to get them to be more mindful and thoughtful and useful, not only to the paper, but to you and to their community, the readers. They are, it's hard work. It's not easy. And time is growing short. And when I titled this panel, Roll Over Gutenberg and Tell McLuhan the News, I'm thinking about death. I'm thinking about the end of the industry as we know it. You know, and I don't necessarily see a rebirth ahead. I'm seeing the body of contemporary, traditional, current media as an exquisite corpse. What that leaves for us is a chance to do something, to be something other than mourners, to be something other than pallbearers. You know, we don't come to bury journalism. We come to praise it. We come to make it better. Most of the time when people come to these conferences and come to these panels, they're focused on, you know, paying attention from a developer's standpoint or point of view. They want to know what will make them money, what will drive eyeballs to their stories, what will be useful. Or they come from, you know, looking to fund something. You know, there were all these stories going around earlier about the possibility of Google buying the San Jose Mercury News. It's the hometown newspaper. It's just down the road. You know, why wouldn't you throw money at it? It's a pittance for a company like Google. But Google has other priorities. And naturally, you know, that's what it's following. And the owner of the Mercury News now, Dean Singleton, who also owns the Times, has other priorities too. He talks a good game about being involved in partnerships with companies like Yahoo and other organizations, and seeing about getting the news out, local news, to people in ways that is useful. I don't know that that's going to be enough. I wish I could be more cheerful. I wish I could be give you a shinier, happier outlook on things. In previous years, when I came to panels on journalism here, we went round and round about the difference between journalism and blogging. Finally, we were able to resolve that this year with the Polk Award, which Josh Marshall received for his work on TalkingPointsMemo.com. You know, he said he sees journalism, you know, not simply as an article with a beginning and an end, but a series of dispatches, a continuous approach. And that requires a different stance. It requires, you know, not just an on-off approach to attention. It requires a mindfulness. I'm 36. I've worked for 13 years in journalism, with the exception of a year at the UC School of Public Health. And clearly, you know, there have been a lot of changes in the industry. What needs to happen, you know, isn't always clear, but there are some things I think that people can take away with them, you know, to look at what needs to happen in journalism. First off, how many of you all work for publications? Please raise your hands. Okay. After this is over, beer's on me. Because you all know what's going on and how difficult these. I see you raising your hands. You just want the beer, fine. Not the happy talk. How many of y'all's publications go where your readers are? Do your publications have accounts on YouTube or Flickr? What about MySpace pages? Y'all are not too snobby for MySpace pages. That's smart. That's smart. I'll tell you, the Contra Costa Times had a MySpace page, has one. But for a while, we weren't able to control it. We needed to find out who had it, and it turned out someone in the advertising division had opened it and was controlling it and putting up information there about it. We were finally able to wrest control of that from advertising. I think there's a joke in there somewhere, but we have an opportunity to be leaders in terms of putting forth the ideals that are, you know, make sense for our community. You know, the point of publishing and bringing information to people, you know, as a service is that, you know, there's money in it. There's a way for it to pay for itself. And while you're doing that, there are ways that you can put forth certain ideas. You know, you can set up your paper so that your email links, you know, offer, you know, information about your writers in micro formats. You can, within the limits of, you know, your concerns about registration and, you know, working with the information you gather about your readers, you can make OpenID a priority. You can make your data more portable. You know, there are lots of things that people can do with publications, and this work is slow, but it's not happening quickly enough, and it should happen more quickly. How many of you all who work on these publications make a point of letting the people you work with know about Creative Commons material? So you do make the point, and you do use it. And how many of you all who are creators put your own material out there, some of your own material, and license it under a Creative Commons format? Papers need their own core issues. When I work at the Times, I find that we get a strong, tremendous response from readers when we focus on issues like health, when we offer, you know, time for people to ask questions about medical issues, particularly about real estate, given the state of, you know, the real estate industry these days. People are looking for free advice. But it's not free if they're giving, you know, their attention and their time. And that's a different kind of payment than, you know, the kind that goes into your wallet every 2 weeks via direct deposit. It's the kind that'll keep readers coming back over time. How many of you all are working with databases when it comes to telling your stories? Not simply managing, you know, content management systems, but creating different tools. That's urgent. That's urgent. One of the stories that the paper is going to be working on in the next week or so talks about how people in, no one from Oakland or Berkeley, California, has been killed in the Iraq War. That's a city of 400,000 people. But in a city 60 miles to the east called Tracy, at least half a dozen people have been killed, half a dozen soldiers who've registered. Now, we're looking at setting up a database that'll allow you to put in a zip code and point out an area on a map, and you'll be able to see how many people have died from a given area in comparison. And that will tag along with the story that'll, you know, interview recruiters and show what kind of work they're doing, what kind of trouble they're running into or issues, and what, you know, resistance they're getting from communities in various aspects. I would point you to it, but all I can do is tell you about it and, you know, hope that you remember the next week when it's up, you can come see it. You know, the idea that, you know, it's not enough to simply think about the story between the headline and your tagline at the end. How many of you all have been to a newspaper's, your local newspaper's story meetings in the morning or the afternoon? How did that go? Biased bad or biased good? Could you expand on that a little? Okay. All right. Say no more. Every one of you needs to go to a news meeting and a newspaper. You don't if you don't care about whether newspapers go away. If you're content to simply get, you know, your state and your national and international news from ap.google.com. but you don't necessarily live in the nation or the world. You live in a community. You come to South by Southwest to be part of a community. And you're getting your news from the social tools that we have, that we're using to keep track of where the next party is, how the next panel is doing, where are we all going after. I went a little around and around with some of the things I wanted to talk about today, and I guess I kept coming back to the idea that, you know, I don't want to hector or preach, but I want you all to think seriously about, I want to charge you all with the idea that you should think of yourselves as members of a community. Don't think about being citizen journalism, because at this point, citizen is a radioactive term. What does it mean to commit journalism, to keep track of stories, to tell stories when you're feeling disenfranchised, when you're walking into the room and it's the New York Sun editorial board? Or even the Huffington Post editorial board, for that matter. If Gutenberg and McLuhan were sitting together in graves, and the one was rolling over and talking to the other, what would they say? They'd say, the tools are there. Corporations are still learning how to use them. You all have a much better grasp on them. You should use them. You should show your papers how to use them. And if you invent a better way to use them, you know, perhaps you should sell that to them. You look at the story in Editor and Publisher last month. Talks about some of the efforts that people are putting in to fix that gap between the publication and the page. 28% of the losses in print readership. It's something, but it's not enough. Not enough to pay for salaries necessarily. Something like 8,000 or 9,000 media jobs have gone away in the last month. And that's not simply salaries, it's people, it's editors, it's people who bring various tools and skill sets. When they go, your paper, you know, such as it is going to read more simply, with less nuance and less vigor. And it isn't necessarily something that these tools can give us or make up for. How many of you all use Twitter? How many of you all have you been using it this weekend at South by Southwest? How many of y'all's hometown newspapers or the publications you work for have Twitter accounts? Much fewer, much fewer. And how many of those publications that use them aren't simply pushing out RSS headlines, updates on the latest bulletin? How do you use yours? Yes. First, could you please stand up and what's your name? Jesus. Would you mind? I'm sorry.
There you go. So it's a different country, so maybe there are different situations there. We don't have as many local newspapers. They work a different way. Most of them are, their funding comes from local governments, so there's not as many problems as you have here. For that, in my particular, our publication, it's related, it's about finance and real estate stuff. And we are backed by a company who has a real estate portal, different situation probably. But Twitter is basically an output of all the news that happen in the main page, which is basically a blog at one point. It's a different structure. And there is a forum that collects all the activity that happens in every news item and in the forum as well.
Thank you.
I don't know if it makes sense, but it works.
What's your publication? How do you spell that? Idealista.
Through here, and now you're getting the news. Is it loading up? So basically, you get the news feed with commentaries and every single news. You have a main forum here we have a weekly archive of the forum. It renovates every week because we think only one forum collates better all the conversations, but we archive that every week. It gets very noisy sometimes, but people quite like it. And we actually made a book out of the commentaries from the people who comments on our forum about, because in Spain and in the US, there is actually a similar situation with real estate. We have a bubble as well. So 3-4 years ago, we already had people commenting on how the bubble was gonna burst and on our forum, and we were able to extract those news, those commentaries from that people into a book, which was quite cool.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point? Are there any other questions? Yes. The key example of these applications being used by publications that sticks with me is the work that KPBS did in San Diego last year with the coverage of the fires that struck Southern California. Nate Ritter wrote about it a little over a month ago. You're seeing that he talked about how Twitter is a tool, how it's good for organizations in some cases, but it's not an easy fit. It's not a one size fits all. There are ways for you to decide what elements of coverage you want to put out to people. It's the same case for some authors as well. You're looking at the benefits here, and he outlines them as speed. You know, you can post more than once a minute. That you can add alerts and reaching people wherever they are, not simply at their desks, but you know, also on phones and other devices. And it's possible to pull together a variety of posts from various sources. You know. And that's at Nate Ritter's site, blog.perfectspace.com. some of the promise of a service like Pounce is that you're not simply working or chained to text, that you can work with photo, that you can work with video clips. There are also ways for you to work with communities of people that are interested in publishing as well, and that can be of use for you. What other questions are there?
So I hope this is a kind of coherent question. I recently read about an argument that's going on right now about whether journalists are afforded protection against naming their sources for certain stories by the fact that they are journalists. And one argument against this protection is that anybody with a blog can claim they're a journalist and then avoid, you know, naming sources for their stories when they're subpoenaed to do so. So intuitively, the protection seems to make good sense to me. It seems to be a social good to have such a thing in place, a kind of whistleblower protection for journalists. But if there is no distinction between a newspaper and a blog, then that argument that says we can't really afford that protection because then anybody can claim it carries more force. So can you maybe talk about that a little bit?
Let me see if I've got this right. You're saying that if anybody has a blog, if anyone can publish, anyone can be a journalist, anyone can be protected, and that means that you're not going to be able to have, you're not going to be able to subpoena folks and get, you know, information. And you're saying this is bad. How?
I'm not really trying to come down on whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying that. The argument, as I understand it, so intuitively, what seems to be true to me is that when a journalist says, I don't want to name my source for a story because if I do so, I can't get sources for stories, I think that's okay. I think that seems, intuitively, it seems to be an okay kind of claim to make because journalists have a certain social responsibility as a watchdog for government, for against abuses of government, for example. But an argument that has been made against affording such a protection to journalists is that in this day and age, anybody can claim they're a journalist by saying, hey, I blog about stuff that makes me a journalist as well. So I am now also immune from having to name sources for various, you know, pieces of information that I might have. So this has been an argument that that some people are making against having such a protection. So to me, there's a benefit in distinguishing very clearly, you know, this is a newspaper, these people are professional journalists, and therefore they get this kind of protection versus people who, you know, who are not doing this professionally and then maybe should not be afforded such a protection.
Not everyone with a blog is a journalist. Not everyone with a blog can claim they are a journalist, not with a straight face and not to a court of law. Granted, the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and people can commit journalism using blogs and various other tools at their disposal, but I don't know. I don't know that it's as much of an issue as let me see if I can get this out right. Journalism is what you do. It's not simply, you know, the tool or, you know, a strategy. It's a tactic, a practice, an effort. And when you commit it, that's when you have the protection. That's when you can claim it. You know, it's not a mask you put on. It's the person behind the mask. It's useful, but I don't think we should allow ourselves to be distracted by it. It's not, you know, complete.
part of our First Amendment protection is that you have the right to say what you want, you know what I mean, within limits. Why should somebody who, because they work for a corporation that has the budget to put out a paper every day, why should they have more protection than somebody just because they're a journalist organization? You know what I mean? It, like George said, it's really the practice. It's the act of discovery, research, reporting, and attempt to be accurate and fair, if not objective, that really is key.
What she said.
Thanks, George. I just wanted to mention an example. People asked about things that people are doing. And Oscar Martinez, who works with the Dallas Morning News' regional editions, their weekly community papers, I think they have 20 of them that they package in various zones with their regular edition on Sundays or Saturdays. And then they also cover, in addition to that, another 45 communities online. He was talking about what they do on Saturday morning, and he said that they've added a lot of tools to their local sections that allow users to submit items for their calendars and also to submit news items and to submit photos. And they've taken some of those things and pushed them out to the front of DallasNews.com or whatever their home webpage is. So they look at that information and they use it. So that might be another example for people to look at who are looking at examples of traditional media companies getting into this space.
Thank you.
My question, and it'll take me a second to get to it, relates back to what you're talking about between what makes a journalist just a moment ago. In the title to your talk, you reference McLuhan, who's famous for saying the medium is the message, which, of course, most of us buy into. And I think the internet is still relatively a new medium that is having an enormous impact on the messages that we're sending out. And I would love to get a sense from you and from this group of what this new, relatively new medium means in terms of ethics, because I'm an old school lover of old school journalism, and I see it dying because budgets are being slashed. You know, the editors have so much more pressure now, the writers have more pressure, you know, how many publications have ombudsmen anymore, you know? There's a definite impact to that. And I used to go to places like the New York Times because I thought that they were the most reliable. And I'm learning that that's a naive viewpoint. And so I just love to talk about that if people are up for that.
There are services around that are working to aggregate a wide variety of web readers' opinions on the accuracy and the viability of news stories, sort of outsourcing the ombudsman function. There's now Public in Vancouver, British Columbia. They're doing some work in terms of not only allowing people to contribute stories, but rating other published stories. The idea that ethics is going away as a function of the changing amount of resources available to the media is, I can't refute it. I can't challenge it. It's pretty much as you describe it. You know, it's partially hobbled, and part of the challenge that the media is going to have to do, not only with fewer people and shrinking resources, but is finding a way to get closer to that ideal that used to exist, that maybe never did exist, but was always sought for. You know, perhaps it was just something that we believed once, and you know, can still sort of, you know, hold up over our heads as a possible ideal.
I just wanted to touch on an example I've seen from an end user consumer standpoint. I mean, I've been out of print media myself for several years, but in my line of work, I researched mortgage fraud and came across the Bakersfield Californian. who, in my opinion, did an excellent job in interacting with their consumers both on and off their news website in regards to a big mortgage fraud scheme that was going on in town. So it kind of created this self-feedback loop where you would have the visitors at the website commenting on the news stories themselves. Because of these interactive users, the newspaper was creating entire data sets, charts, interrelated activities dealing with this scam, and that popped over into the blogosphere where, you know, your individual bloggers would take the information, talk about it back and forth, point out the best linked articles, other resources, and that sort of thing. So there's not really a question attached to that, but just I know others have been asking for examples of you know, kind of well thought out concepts. And that's just one that occurred to me because, you know, it really helped me get in touch with the right people as far as what I was looking into. Thank you.
Thank you. The Bakersfield Californian is one of the few papers out there that does a wonderful job of aggregating its readers' content in terms of creating databases and, you know, doing just what you described.
Yeah, hi. I walked in a little late, so I'm not sure if you talked about Boston Now newspaper. Did you mention that at all?
I have not.
Boston Now. Okay. Anyone here from Boston? Do you know Boston Now? Okay. I just wanted to point that out. It's a really interesting paper. My former boss, I'm a longtime print journalist. My former boss started this. It's a tabloid-sized paper. It's mostly distributed in, downtown Boston and all throughout the subway system and everything. And they started out with the concept, brand new paper, and they started with bloggers' posts running right alongside staff-written articles. Every blog post has a symbol on top so you know you're reading a blog post, and then the news stories just run as news stories. And they plan to open other branches throughout the country, so it'll be like Chicago Now and so forth. I don't know what to make of it. I've contributed myself, but I find it as a blogger a little bit frustrating because I'm used to just putting stuff up. Nobody tells me what I can or can't write, and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I'll write an item for Boston Now, and it doesn't go up, and I'm disappointed. I guess I'm a little, you get kind of piggy after a while because you're so used to publishing your own stuff. But anyway, I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that type of how print is sort of trying to introduce blogging as well.
I'm seeing that the Houston Chronicle does a wonderful job. They're probably the busiest of the papers that are out there. Cron.com. And that Boston site is bostonnow.com.
Oh, hi. All right. I'm a print reporter. And we're covering the festival, obviously, and we had the first video of Zuckerberg and the keynote and the response from Sarah Lacey that I shot. I think we scooped all the video bloggers, we scooped Ballywag and everybody online, you know, that was there with the video cameras, and I'm not sure why they didn't post videos right away, but we did. I think it's possible. I mean, I think we can do the online thing well and consistently. But I know I had to fight every step of the way, and my editor had to fight every step of the way.
Would you identify yourself? You're Omar.
Omar Gayagaya with the Statesman here in town. But we had to fight to get, you know, a good, decent camera. We had to fight to get a tripod to go there. We had to fight to get somebody to edit the video when we were done with it. You know, I had to upload the video myself to YouTube because the videographer went home, you know, after the Zuckerberg thing. I mean, you know, it was a clusterfuck, but it was worth it. But the thing is, if my editor didn't believe in what I was doing, it just wouldn't have happened. And I think it's people that are at the ground level, people that are out reporting, that have to fight to get these things online in a timely way and to get them out there. And if you don't have people like that within your newsroom, that stuff's never going to happen.
You'll have to excuse him cursing. He's a goddamn journalist. And this man knows exactly what he speaks of. I don't know how many of you all were in the room for the Zuckerberg panel. How many of you all were taking notes as it happened? How many of you all were live blogging it? How many of you all were capturing on audio or video? How long did it take to get your video up?
I think it was up within 2 hours.
And
the original Zuckerberg, the Lacey thing was completely by chance. I happened to be at a party. and saw her. I had my little point and shoot. I went up to her, can I shoot you on video? And I uploaded that to YouTube immediately. And then had to take it down because she dropped an F-bomb in the video. So I had to re-edit the video to upload it so we could embed it on our site.
These are your tools. These are not the Statesman's tools. You own your own.
No, it was my personal YouTube, and I embedded it on the Statesman blog.
Thank you.
Okay. I actually have something to kind of add to that. Would you mind sharing your
Mike name?
Rucker from Time Out New York Magazine. We're obviously a magazine, a weekly magazine, not a daily. But one of the things that we find, I'm actually blogging I'm the marketing director, but I'm blogging and I'm posting stuff on YouTube as we speak, just because there aren't a lot of resources. And what we find at the weekly magazine, and this is something that I don't think you've delved deeply enough into, is both Omar's point where there's a lack of resources, but also we find that, I mean, everybody on the editorial staff is already, you know, eyeball deep in their duties for the print publications. So everything that needs to be done online is just additional work for a lot of them. And then you get people who are enthusiastic about the new media and who see the positive effects that it can have on their personal careers by embracing, you know, video blogging and kind of getting their names out there and even PR, online PR. But at the same time, everything that they do with new media distracts and takes them away from some of the daily or weekly duties that they have as part of the print publication. And I think that is going to be a problem until publications can figure out the balance. I mean, our magazine itself is moving more and more toward online. We have a couple of blogs, some video blogs, video content. But again, it just takes people away. It feels like extra work. So I think that that's going to be kind of a stumbling block until organizations can figure it out.
You're saying it feels like extra work, but it is also necessary.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. But, you know, people are only willing to work as much as they can work. If they're already putting in 60, 70 hours a week on the print publication to, you know, re-edit stories or embed links or shoot video or any of the other things that we're talking about, it is extra work. So, the bulk of our budget comes from print advertising. So that's got to be that's got to be where the focus of everybody's efforts really lies. So, I think that that's something that maybe people should, or maybe, you know, you might want to delve into. What's the process? How do you get it? How do you get this shift, you know, in thinking and in resources?
Thank you. The shift is going to take time. The shift is going to take the shakeout of the industry. The shift is going to take, you know, the hollowing out of some of the large organizations, you know, not simply, sadly, because for efficiency purposes, but, you know, they're going to have to lose some of these folks. And that's something that is happening at my paper now and some of the papers in the Bay Area and, you know, some of the larger metro papers all over. And it's just suffering and destruction ahead until we get to the point.
Hi, George. My name is William Lawrence from Santa Cruz, California. Excuse my voice. You know, South by. Anyway, I don't normally talk like this. Anyway, so
Santa Cruz Sentinel.
No, I'm not a journalist.
Oh, okay.
But I do look at the paper. On the newsstand, I look at it. I don't pick it up. So one of the problems we have in Santa Cruz is the Sentinel used to be local, is no longer local. It's part of a larger sort of family now. And so the sort of the focus in the community, to the community, is kind of gone. I guess what I'm saying is, like, a lot of people in Santa Cruz are upset about this. And so what they do is they revert to the local weekly newspaper, you know. You know, it's not really the same. It's not about news, just kind of local events, cultural events, what's going on, what's important. when it comes to actual news, the kids, the folks in Santa Cruz, are wanting something more. What you talked about earlier with the blogs, you know, the some personality, you know, having a blog on the on their site is kind of helping bring that sort of freshness, that localization back into it. One of the things we're trying to do is trying to set up citizen journalism as a, sort of a tool, not to replace it, but to like put a worm in their ass, pardon my French, but, you know, to sort of get them going, to sort of, I don't know, you know, just go. So anyway, I was just curious what you,
I'm not much into the idea of citizen journalism, but I like the idea. You basically, what you're describing is people participating. People going up to this paper, which used to be owned by Ottaway Newspapers and is now owned by Media News Group out of Denver, the same corporation that owns the Times, where I work. I don't know about the extent to which changes are afoot in the Sentinel, but I can tell you that there are people in that organization that want more people to participate. You have not... have you gone to any of these news meetings?
No.
You haven't darkened the door of the Sentinel just yet?
No, I'm just a lurker.
Okay. Well, lurking is good. Lurking is useful because, you know, it gives you a certain vantage. But if I get to talk with you afterwards, I'd like to hear more about your take on this.
What about going beyond blogs? ChicagoCrime.org. is an excellent example of how of journalism, but not journalism in a blog sort of way or in a story sort of way. They take it's a mashup of Google Maps and Chicago police data laid out so you can see which neighborhoods not to go through at night. So I mean, I think more newspapers need to do that kind of stuff. Adopt technologies that let people be more engaged, and I would like to know. What your thoughts are on that. You mentioned the Contra Costa Times project, the database project. Should newspapers be doing things like that? What would you like to see? How can we have that conversation with our local media to say, give us the tools to help us be better citizens?
If there is any hope for journalism, it is in work like ChicagoCrime.org and with people like Adrian Holovaty, who set up ChicagoCrime.org and has now launched everyblock.com in San Francisco and New York and Chicago. Here you'll see a page that catalogs crimes by date, neighborhood, zip code, you know, type, place and beat. And I live in Oakland, and let's see crime. Oakland.crimespotting.org is a tool that uses Oakland Police Department data to catalog these crimes as well. And you can slide a menu down here and change the date or filter out recent crimes. Looks like there was a sexual assault recently near where I live, but I've been here. Of a sort.
My name is Cinnamon Cooper, and I'm a writer with GapersBlock.com, which is a Chicago-centric news and event site. And we started the website to combat what we felt was the over-corporatization of sort of the media. We felt that there was so much going on in Chicago that wasn't getting represented by the Sun-Times and the Tribune. And so we wanted to draw attention to a lot of smaller, less publicly recognized events and news items. But most of what we pull are links from other places. A lot of that is blogs. And so while we don't write a whole lot of new news content, we write a lot of feature content that's original, but we consider ourselves citizen journalists. So I'm curious if how you can if you can elaborate on why you find citizen journalism bad, since that's kind of what we consider ourselves, and we're not bad.
I think about citizen journalism as I don't know, a citizen is sort of an atomized, it's a label. I think of a citizen nowadays as sort of like an atomized unit. I'm thinking of community journalism as, you know, something that takes into account a multiplicity of perspectives that are around an issue or a story. Journalism works best, stories work best when they're able to incorporate, you know, multiple perspectives. Granted, it's coming out of one mouth, but the tools we have let us know that they don't simply have to come out of one mouth, that, you know, things can sort of blend together. You talked before, you and I have talked before about the objectivity in journalism. And if there isn't going to be a single objective voice, if there isn't simply going to be someone holding tablets and handing down the word from Michigan Avenue or a newspaper building, then let there be many voices. You know, if the journalism is going to have an exquisite corpse, let there be many worms and let them bite people's asses. What was your question? All right.
Hello. I have kind of a playful question. I'm not a journalist. I'm a reader, kind of a voracious reader. And I had this moment of delight the other day because I discovered that NPR has news feeds, or feeds that go onto Twitter so that I can read, you know, headlines updated every other second or that type of thing. It was just immensely satisfying. And so I guess I'm kind of wondering if you can talk about like little tools or kind of visions of the future of how that type of thing can be added into print publications or newspapers to make people engage in a different type of way with the information.
I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but I'm looking. If you come up to me afterwards, I will share some of the tools I have here.
Hey, my name is Dave. I work at the Houston Chronicle Online. You mentioned our blogs earlier. I just kind of want to explain how we use blogs at the paper. We have three different tiers of bloggers. We have a staff blogger, which is the most trusted blogger on the payroll. We have a second tier of bloggers who are kind of public citizens who are blogging for us, but they've been approved and trusted by our editors. And then we have everyone else. And we promote bloggers up through the ranks to find talent. So,
who got this going? Who got the ball rolling?
Dwight Silverman set up the blogs at the Houston Chronicle. So he's...
And to your mind, to your way of, to, as far as you know, he has the ear of the publishers.
He has the ear of the online editors and, sure, the publishers, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. If anyone has any other questions, I'd like to extend an invitation later on to continue the conversation. You're welcome to come here. I'll be posting about my panel, and you all are welcome to comment. And I'd like to end here and say thank you for sticking around. You didn't have to stay, but you did, and because you're interested in the issue. I'm not as confident about how well I addressed it, but I'm looking forward to figuring out where things are going from here. Thank you for your time.